Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a coup in Zimbabwe that so far has been bloodless and speak with Ambassador John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations, who was a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial election. He is the author of Mourning in South Africa and joins us to discuss the military coup in Zimbabwe that has the 93-year-old President Robert Mugabe under house arrest, along with his younger wife, Grace Mugabe, who has been criticized for her conspicuous consumption in a desperately poor country and likened to Imelda Marcos and Eva Peron. We'll look into whether the military will bring back Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who Mugabe recently sacked, and how the generals who are veterans of the War of Liberation from white rule in the 1970s will neutralize the unpopular Grace Mugabe while treating the popular and revered Robert Mugabe with kid gloves. Then we'll examine the exhibition of far-right-wing nationalism and fascism on display in Warsaw, Poland over the weekend by more than 60,000 that coincided with Poland's 99th Independence Day, with marchers carrying banners with clean blood and white Europe emblazoned, while white supremacists chanted Sieg Heil in a country where the Nazis carried out the worst atrocities. Jan Kubrick, a professor of political science at Rutgers University and a professor in the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London, and author of 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration, joins us to discuss the apparent complicity of the Polish government, since the only arrests by the police were 45 counter-protesters, and Poland's foreign minister called it a great celebration of Poles united around the common values of freedom and loyalty to an independent homeland. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the House and Senate's so-called tax reform bills that have been negotiated in secret with the Democrats excluded, which the House might vote on as early as Thursday. Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss how the Republicans are scrambling to find pots of money to offset the enormous tax cuts to corporations and the richest Americans by going after blue states, postgraduate students, and in the case of the Senate bill, grabbing over $300 billion from the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a career Foreign Service officer and a former ambassador to Nigeria and political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, and Mourning in South Africa. That's Mourning, M-O-R-N-I-N-G. And he blogs at CFR.org, where you go to Campbell. His latest post there is Zimbabwe coup, bloodless so far. So that's the situation. There's a coup, but it's a bloodless coup. And what is behind this coup?
It's essentially an internal struggle within the ruling ZANU-PF party. In other words, it's a palace coup. It's a coup amongst the various factions that have been running the country. What, in fact, the coup is really all about is who is going to succeed Robert Mugabe, who is 93 years of age and in poor health.
Well, it looks as though Mugabe wants his wife to succeed him, because he recently fired the heir apparent, did he not?
And that's exactly right. There are really two factions that are contesting the succession right now. One is associated with the old veterans of the struggle against white minority rule. The face of that group is the fired vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. The other faction is led by Mugabe's wife, Grace Mugabe. And it appears that when Mugabe fired the vice president, that was taken as a clear signal that he was going to support his wife as his successor. And that led the military to move. Now, Mugabe and his wife are under house arrest. Mugabe has not been deposed as president. However, the people that have made the coup say that the purpose is essentially to remove corrupt, incompetent, and evil people who are around him.
Well, would that be Grace Mugabe?
One wonders. Now, actually going after the wife of an icon such as Mugabe carries risks. Mugabe, though he's anathema in the West, retains substantial popularity in the rural parts of Zimbabwe and indeed all over Africa as a hero of the liberation movement. What I would suspect is that in the short term, her immediate associates called the G40 are likely to be deprived of any power. It's interesting, the finance minister was arrested this morning, and other cabinet officers have apparently gone into hiding. But I would be surprised if they actually touched her.
Well, she is, though, shall we say, controversial. There was an incident in South Africa where it was pretty clear she beat up a woman. I think it might have been actually a call girl that her sons had brought, invited into the hotel suite.
That's right.
And she escaped. Obviously, Zuma let her go. I guess the real question here is, Ambassador Campbell, is does Mugabe still have all of his faculties, and is she manipulating him? And is that what's going on here?
Extremely unclear. Mugabe is indeed 93 years old. He goes down quite frequently to Singapore for medical treatment. He fairly regularly falls asleep at public occasions. But at other times, he seems to be very much in control, such as when he fired the vice president last weekend. So I think the jury's out on that one.
Well,
I would also note, for what it's worth, that his mother lived to be 103.
Well, didn't he have a conversation with Jacob Zuma today?
He did indeed. Jacob Zuma called him on the phone, and Mugabe assured Zuma that while he was essentially under house arrest, he was fine.
Well, let's talk a little about Grace Mugabe, because she sort of casts somewhat, and you make the point that there's a whole difference between the way Africans see Mugabe and possibly his wife. I'm not sure about that, but certainly Mugabe is a hero, whereas in the West he's under sanctions and considered a kleptocrat and a catastrophe for his country. And certainly in the West, Mugabe's wife Grace is not seen in a very positive light and considered something of a throwback to Imelda Marcos or Eva Perón. How would you describe her?
I think the comparison with Imelda Marcos and Eva Perón is apt. It's difficult to be very precise, but anecdotal evidence would indicate that she's not very popular in Zimbabwe either, particularly in what is a very, very poor country. Her conspicuous consumption, the episode you referred to where she punched out a call girl in South Africa, that is by no means isolated. There was an incident last year in Hong Kong, for example, where she punched out, I believe it was a hotel worker. And in both times she was able to invoke diplomatic immunity. This is not dignified behavior that Africans expect of their first ladies.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a career Foreign Service officer and former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria. He was also political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, and Mourning in South Africa. And he blogs at cscfr.org, where you go to Campbell. And his latest posting is Zimbabwe coup bloodless so far. So what's going on here then? Obviously, the fact that it's a bloodless coup, the military moved in with their armored vehicles and took over the palace. Mugabe's under house arrest, but as you pointed out, in a phone conversation with the South African president, he apparently certainly seems like he has his faculties together and basically said that he's not been harmed. So let's talk then about the factions here. If this is a factional palace coup, at this point, it would seem that the older crowd, the veterans, led, I guess, are they're led by the head of the military, but he's an ally of the recently sacked Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, right?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
So how they're up against what, the youth wing, right? And Grace Mugabe.
Not anymore. No, not anymore. It's very interesting. Within the past few hours, the youth wing has disavowed its spokesman that said they were prepared to die for Mugabe, and the youth wing has demanded that the spokesman apologize to the military. Also within the past few hours, the Veterans Association has come out in support of the military. So right now, I don't see any opposition within ZANU-PF to the coup. Now, some may manifest itself, but I don't see any right now. Nor does there seem to be any opposition outside of Harare.
Well, but then what's it all about? I mean, you don't send tanks into...
Basically, it's about who within ZANU-PF is going to succeed Mugabe, and the answer to that now is somebody that comes from the faction associated with the fired vice president and with the military and with the veterans of the struggle.
And does that exclude or include the vice president who was just sacked, Emmerson Mnangagwa?
Oh, I think it very definitely includes him. I mean, I think he, in effect, is the titular leader of that faction.
But didn't you tell us...
My expectation would be that he will... he's apparently in South Africa now, that he will return very soon to Zimbabwe. And I would not be the least bit surprised if he doesn't become some kind... not exactly interim head of state, because I think he will keep Mugabe as a kind of figurehead, but in effect the ruler of the country.
But didn't you tell us a little while ago, Ambassador John Campbell, that Mugabe approved the sacking of the vice president? Or is there some ambiguity there? Could it have been Grace Mugabe?
No, there's no ambiguity. Right. No ambiguity at all. The President Mugabe, in fact, ordered the sacking of the vice president. So there's no ambiguity. Mm-hmm. What the sacked vice president, though, has to bear in mind is Mugabe's residual popularity, both in Zimbabwe and in Africa. And keeping him, as it were, propped up, almost as a kind of hood ornament for a regime, politically, I think, would be quite useful for him.
But it sounds like you're not going to ease Grace Mugabe out of the way easily, right? She's a pretty fiery personality, and I suspect that that's... Is that the subtext here, that the military just couldn't stomach her being head of state?
Yes and no. The subtext is that the military insists on a successor to Mugabe being one of their own, and Grace Mugabe is not. Grace Mugabe was 15 years old when the country ended white minority rule. She obviously could not and did not participate in the liberation struggle. The leaders of the faction that are now dominant all did.
So what is the situation vis-a-vis her then? I mean, you said that she doesn't have much popular support. She's considered rather profligate in her spending in a desperately poor country. The military don't like her. What is her support?
I would suspect for both of them that they will be kept under what amounts to house arrest.
But with sort of velvet gloves?
Yes. In other words, they're presently, for example, being kept in their private house.
Uh-huh. So how does that explain to the public, the people of Zimbabwe, that your leader, who you revere, is actually under arrest, but nobody's going to harm him, and what legitimacy will his successors have?
Well, it'll depend with on how much subtlety the new government shows. I mean, after all, keeping Mugabe under house arrest does not preclude bringing him out for public events, public occasions, such as the opening of Parliament and that kind of thing.
I see. So he might well go along with it?
Well, he won't have much choice.
Right. Right, but having the guy that he sacked come back, that's sort of a pretty clear signal that he's not in charge.
Oh, it is indeed. And he sure isn't in charge. I mean, he's right. Now under house arrest.
Right, right.
And there's no visible opposition to it. Now, some may manifest itself, but up to now, there is no visible opposition to it.
So will this trigger a kind of reversal of the sanctions and the opening of all of the Western contacts that have been cut off, the credit, diplomatic recognition, etc.? Where does that stand, do you think?
Well, it raises the potential for it, but not right away. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the post-Mugabe government, as we can sort of foresee at present, is going to be virtually identical to the Mugabe government. In other words, behavior isn't going to change, the policies aren't going to change, and therefore the basis for the sanctions isn't going to change. Now, whenever you have a change of government, even if it's just at the very top, there is the potential for things to open up. There is the potential for Harare to move in a different direction, but it's by no means guaranteed.
Well, wouldn't that be leverage, though, on the part of the incoming government, that your misery may end, your isolation may end, your poverty may end?
Interesting that they've not used that rhetoric.
Uh-huh. But that's a fact, isn't it? That the isolation that Mugabe has provoked from the international community is what's, along with the mismanagement of the economy and the country in general, with the massive inflation. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the banknotes. I've got one that's...
Oh, I even have some.
Yeah, it's got $1 trillion. Yeah. Dollars. So yeah. Just in the last minute, what's your sense of whether people, in spite of their affection for Mugabe, would actually like the sanctions to end and the country to be functional again?
A difference of view between Harare and Bulawayo, the two largest cities in the most modern parts of the country, and the countryside. Mugabe's support has always been in the countryside, not amongst those who want Zimbabwe to participate in the modern economy. Harare, the capital city, has been a center of opposition to Mugabe for years. Countryside still with him.
Well, Ambassador John Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria and political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, and Mourning in South Africa. And he blogs at cfr.org, where you go to Campbell, where his latest posting is Zimbabwe Coup Bloodless So Far. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the display of right-wing nationalism and fascism in Warsaw, Poland over the weekend.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jan Kubik, who is a professor of political science at Rutgers and a professor in the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. His books include The Power of Symbols Against the Symbols of Power, Post-Communism from Within, Social Justice, Mobilization and Hegemony, and 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jan Kubik.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I must say the demonstrations that took place in Warsaw, Poland over the weekend with a march by 60,000 that coincided with Poland's 99th Independence Day was pretty shocking. The New York Times has an editorial today expressing shock and disgust at the banners that these white supremacist marchers were carrying, clean blood and white Europe. Some were chanting Sieg Heil in a country where the Nazis carried out some of their worst atrocities. So it's very hard to understand, frankly. So can you shed some light on what could possibly be happening in Poland?
Well, it is both difficult to understand and, on the other hand, quite easy. The difficulty is when you look at it, and you see it for the first time and you do not know more about what's going on in Poland and the effect of, over 60,000 people demonstrating under those banners and those absolutely awful slogans, purely fascist. It is indeed shocking. But if you spend some time looking back, and if you know a little bit, my job is to follow this for, been doing it for quite a while. It is not that shocking because this part of the political spectrum that was so spectacularly presented itself so spectacularly in the streets on Saturday, it's been there for quite a while. I suspect that people were thinking like that and had those views even under communism, so even before 1989. But more or less since 2000s, early 2000s, they started organizing. They started creating various groups. They revived some fascist organizations of the interwar period, and they started participating particularly in the celebrations of this day. So November the 11th was the national holiday before the war, officially just for 2 years. It is the day where Poland regained independence after World War I. And this was the holiday that was banned by the communists. And then it was revived after 89. And those groups started participating and actually hijacked the whole day eventually since like 2010, 2011, really. So every year you had several organized celebrations that the government would have its own, some parties had their own, and those groups, semi-fascist, radical right groups, started marching. First, those marches were not huge, but every year slightly bigger, and this year was by far the biggest. So there is a view that this is not necessarily that suddenly you have so many more new semi-fascists or fascists in Poland, but you simply have the people who had those views finally getting together in an organized manner and getting, in a way, their act together, which is scary in itself, obviously. But I suspect there will be a very strong counter-reaction, and it already has been some.
Well, now, is this to say then, Jan Kubik, that you're saying that these people have always been around? Would they have been the people during World War II that collaborated with the Nazis?
No, they're way too young.
The heirs to them. In other words,
it's very hard to say. This is something. I do not have any good data yet on. I am beginning the project on that. Who they are? They seem to be most of them young people who are not very well educated, who have the sense that they lost something in the transition from communism, that they may be unemployed, they may be underemployed. They have some problem that they're trying to figure out how to solve, and they are increasingly sort of going public with this content in the form of some of fascist organization and fascist under the fascist banners. How many of them are there altogether? Nobody is quite sure. But the biggest problem is that the present government is not condemning them quite clearly as it should and as decisively as it should. Although some officials express dismay, for example, the President Duda actually, and I was surprised, I have to say, positively surprised. He's usually a little bit wooden and not very excitable, but I saw him for the first time visibly angry that this is happening, whereas the ruling party and Kaczynski, the leader of the ruling party, is has not been as vocal and as clear as the president. So there's this possible some kind of split between them. It's not clear, but there were a few officials, but just a few, who expressed dismay. There were also some who, in the most disgusting and idiotic way, were trying to portray the situation as nothing to worry about, and that it was a joyous holiday in which many families with children participating, and only on the margins there were some radical idiots who did what the whole world saw. Of course, this was not marginal. It was central, because no other celebration was so big and so central, because they were in the center of Warsaw.
Right.
So this is a serious concern, no doubt in my mind whatsoever.
Well, Poland's foreign minister on Monday said that the day had been a great celebration of Poles differing in their views, but united around the common values of freedom and loyalty to an independent homeland. But the interior minister was asked by a reporter about the, and the interior minister is, of course, a member of Poland's right-wing government.
Oh, yes, all of them are.
Yeah, and he was asked by a reporter, what did he think of the banners and chants of Sieg Heil and banners of White Europe and Pure Blood? And the interior minister said, it's only your opinion because you behave like a political activist, he replied to the reporter. And the fact that the only people that were arrested were 45 counter-protesters would indicate to me that the government was pretty sympathetic, or at least hands-off, as far as this demonstration went.
Well, the government was hands-off, this is clear. The government didn't come up with a clear statement, for example, from the prime minister condemning this whole thing, which is absolutely necessary. And yes, some ministers, including the interior minister, produced statements that are simply disgusting and unacceptable in the civilized world. They have no doubt about it.
And again,
that is something that needs to be stopped immediately and needs to be absolutely clearly and uniformly condemned by the top officials of the country in one voice. Even the fact that they speak with different voices already creates not only confusion, but gives people this idea of some license. The worst thing is that without the strong condemnation from the government, those fascist youngsters may think that that this is somehow condoned by the government, that there's nothing wrong with it, and they need to get the message that it is absolutely horrible and unacceptable. They do not seem to understand the history of their own country. They do not seem to understand that what fascism was and what the enormous tragedy and devastation it brought to their grandfathers, fathers, and of course their neighbors, mostly Jews, suffered. But, you know, the anti-Semitic overtones in this whole affair are just horrific, and some of those slogans were clearly, as you know, simply anti-Semitic. So this element of Polish culture is revived somehow in those events, and it is not clearly and loudly condemned by the government again. I mean, some of them, some officials, and the president clearly did, but, you know, this cacophony of voices, the fact that the government doesn't speak with one voice is just, stunning.
And again, I'm speaking with Jan Kubik, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University and a professor in the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. His latest book is 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration. Well, I mentioned the Interior Ministry of the government praising the march. He also, you know, the marchers were masked, these young men, and they were holding up these torches that were belching out this red smoke with flares, etc. And the Interior Minister said, looking out at the sort of crimson fog that the march produced across Warsaw, referring to it as a beautiful sight. And of course, these young men were chanting along with Sieg Heil, etc., death to the enemies of the homeland. Who are the enemies of the homeland? That's the part. When you say they were kind of marooned after the fall of communism, that's not to suggest that they have any nostalgia for communism. I understand that the Poles hated the Russian occupation and, by extension, communism.
Well, but by now, it is a on the one hand, this is a country which is in the state of a very deep culture war. You know, when we talked, when I was in Warsaw in the summer, I was talking to you about the other part of political spectrum, which was very encouraging, defending the constitution. Also, tens of thousands of people in the streets of Warsaw. So you have a country that is very deeply divided. Now, those people from a few days ago, they are, you know, the minimum, completely confused about what they want, how they want it, you know, under what slogans they demand certain things. They, as I already mentioned, they do not seem to understand the first thing about the Polish history. They are united at the base by the hatred of liberal democracy, of the institutions of checks and balances, constitutionalism, the rule of law, and so on. They are united by the hatred of European Union, if not Europe. They believe that you have many, many sort of statements like that, that some kind of evil is coming to Poland from European Union, although Poland is benefiting enormously from structural funds and, you know, all forms of financial support. And they hate cosmopolitanism. They hate educated elites. It is not that different from you know, what we see in this country at the moment, right? And of course, it is unfortunately happening in quite a few places around the world, particularly in Europe and here. By the way, they were joined by sizable groups. I don't know yet the numbers of their counters, right-wing, far right-wing counterparts from other countries of Europe. What they want is not entirely clear, but they want to challenge the existing order. You know, the main slogan, in addition to all those horrific things that you mentioned, the main slogan under which they demonstrated was, "We want God." So, you know, go figure what kind of Bible they are reading, you know, with this, you know, clearly, visually and sort of in their performance demonstrated hatred. Now you ask me against whom, you know, this is traditionally there is always the possibility in, unfortunately, in the Polish culture to sort of revive somehow the anti-Semitic strands of Polish culture. You know, for those young people it is very puzzling because they have not been in contact much with the actual Jewish people. But the same thing, another enemy is Islam and Muslims, which is, you know, the minuscule number of Muslims in Poland. So they basically are fed by kind of mythologized story of the destruction of Europe by the hordes of Muslims coming from somewhere. And the you know, whatever you would call fact-checking in this situation and trying to talk in some reasonable way, it doesn't register at all. And, you know, unfortunately, the present government often produced statements that were going in the same direction, you know, that somehow Poland is threatened by those hordes of Muslims. There's no meaningful, sensible discussion of you know, EU's refugee policy, and you know, to what degree and in what way Poland could help. You know, another thing is the incredibly high level of misogyny. Although there are women, quite a few women in this movement, but there is this hysterical. I don't even know how to call it, because not even its reaction, the kind of imagining of what gender is, you know, to gender for them is some form of evil ideology that is designed to destroy traditional family, to promote homosexualism, which they think is the source of tremendous evil. They are extremely homophobic. And you know, this is really a very dark culture. And how large it is, how strong it is, I still think it's, well, it is, you know, I'm pretty sure it's not the majority, but it is a group that is now very loud. And the key thing is that such institutions as the government or the Catholic Church should absolutely clearly and without any hesitation, with one voice, tell them that this is unacceptable and it has to stop. And what is perhaps the worst part of that story is that this is not happening yet.
Well, of course, when Trump was in Warsaw early this year, he was the one who said, "We want God." So I don't know whether they were picking up on that.
Well, those are the words of John Paul II, mm-hmm. from, you know, already going back to 1979. So in that context, those were extremely powerful and important words that served people well in their fight against communism. And they were very much, you know, behind this idea, right. Was behind at least part of the Solidarity's own ideology in its struggle against the communist rule. But Trump, of course, put it when he said that it in the context in which he said that during this visit, where he was surrounded mostly by people who were extremely happy that he was there, so it was predominantly right-wing crowd that was manufactured to a point to welcome him to Warsaw. So in this context, you know, many years later, those words really mean something different. They can be read as support for a very narrow sort of right-wing nationalistic interpretation of Polish Catholicism. So, you know, more liberal, more open-minded, more kind of cosmopolitan, internationalized Catholics cannot find themselves in this language and in those ceremonies. And that was, you know, already clear then. And, you know, by repeating this phrase, I don't know, of course, what they have in mind, but I know many people notice that this kind of links to Trump than to John Paul II.
Sure. Well, Jan Kubik, I thank you very much for joining us and filling us in, trying to help us understand what this ugly manifestation is about. And hopefully it will be dealt with. I thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, and all my best.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Jan Kubik, who's Professor of Political Science at Rutgers, and he's a professor in the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. His latest book is 20 Years After Communism, The Politics of Memory and Commemoration. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an analysis of the House and Senate's so-called tax reform bills.
Tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Silvia Allegretto, who's a labor economist and the co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvia Allegretto.
Always nice to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. And everything that you work on and care about is not in the Republican tax reform, in quotes, bill that they're likely to vote on as early as tomorrow in the House. And, of course, there's a competing bill in the Senate. In many ways, they're competing to basically screw the middle class, even though they're selling this as a gift to the middle class. So go figure.
Yeah, they're trying very hard to sell this tax plan, which is really, as you know, more of what we've been calling supply-side or trickle-down economics for decades now, which has been completely discredited. All you have to do is look at the vast and ever-widening degree of inequality that we have in this country due to some of those policies that have been implemented over the last couple of decades, to know that this is going to be more of the same. These are not policies that, by and large, are going to go to help the middle class. The vast majority of this tax plan, for instance, is going to go straight to the top 1%, the top, 0.01%.
Well, the move on the part of Senate Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, that, of course, comes with a certain amount of trepidation, I think, because we've seen what's happened in their attempts to kill Obamacare, and this seems like yet another attempt, albeit through the back door. But what seems to be motivating the Senate Republicans is the idea that there's $338 billion in deficit savings that they can grab hold of, and that seems to be what's motivating them. They're just looking around for pots of money to grab to offset the extraordinary gifts that they're giving to corporate America with a massive tax cut in the corporate tax rate, and also the pass-through rates, which are going to blow a hole in the deficit and raise the debt enormously. So that seems to be what's going on here. They're just literally looking for money to offset taxes, tax cuts for the wealthy, for the high earners, via pass-throughs, and for corporate America.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. And it's interesting because, typically this is the party that doesn't like deficits, and they're always talking about balanced budgets, which I typically don't agree with necessarily. But it does matter who you're going into debt for. There's good debt and there's bad debt. So they're looking at small pots of money, like, the student loan interest deduction, for instance, to fill in this large, extremely large, and it looks like a gap that will be growing over time. So first of all, they're never going to be able to fill the gap with the type of tax breaks that they're going to be giving to the wealthy, but they're going to try to fill in as much as they can on the backs of the working class. and it's never going to work. And like I said, I'm not someone who preaches balanced budgets, but because it does matter what you're going into debt for, and this certainly is not a good use of our money. And really, as we've talked about so many times on your programs over the years, one of the biggest issues we have in this country is inequality. It's not that we're not wealthy enough. We're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. The problem is the distribution of wealth. And this is just going to ratchet up all of those issues and make things so much worse and make it so much harder for the average hard-working and very productive American to make ends meet.
Well, the idea, though, that graduate students who, you know, they really live hand to mouth. I mean, those getting, you would know, you're a professor.
I've still got student loans to pay off.
Right. Well, you know, they live hand to mouth to get their PhDs. And, you know, this is something that the country needs. They need highly skilled workers, particularly, you know, the innovative economy, the Silicon Valley types. They're bringing in brain power and PhDs from abroad. So here you have a situation where the Republicans, I don't know whether it's some peculiar anti-intellectual bent, this is a House bill, but
right.
Why would they do this? Why would you punish graduate students, many of them who are married and have their spouses working, and, you know, they have to do teaching gigs to pay the bills, mm-hmm. and they're living, you know, literally on crumbs.
Right.
And the idea that you would quadruple their taxes, I mean, of all the mm-hmm. people to go after, it seems like so wrong-headed, if not cruel.
Right, but I think you answered that when you said, you know, they're just looking. They're going looking for any type of place that they can, you know, make up some of this large hole that they're blowing in the budget to make it seem like that they're really, you know, concerned about, you know, deficits and debt, when clearly they're signaling that they're not, when it's convenient to give tax breaks to the wealthy. But to go after students, I mean, look at what's happening to public education from K through 12. They're trying to starve the beast and saying, you know, and privatizing everything. They're trying to make it harder and harder because, you know, about student loans and to get student loans and the federal guaranteed student loan programs that are lacking in comparison to the increase in costs for even undergrads. So I think it's just, you know, it's just one more step in, you know, the complete dismantling of making it easy or reasonable for especially working class kids to go to any decent school from kindergarten or, you know, actually we can start a preschool. We don't have the degree of, you know, and the wide-ranging opportunities for parents to send their kids all the way from preschool all the way up to college and graduate degree. So I don't think it's very surprising. It's unfortunate. It's unfair, which is this whole tax, you know, policy that they're talking about is really, in my mind, a moral document, and it is about fairness. And we cannot. I just don't know how much more of this inequality and how much more growth in inequality we can actually sustain.
And again, I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. So what this game is all about is obviously the Republicans are trying to satisfy their donors at the same time con their voters into believing that they're actually going to get a middle class tax cuts, and when in fact the whole tax package is weighted for the super rich and for corporate America. And as I mentioned, the pass-through both in the House and Senate bill, there's a difference between the two. But in general, if you can call yourself a corporation, if you're a wealthy doctor, lawyer, dentist, whatever, and pass your taxes through and not have to and pay as little as 10-15% instead of 39%, you better believe people are going to jump on that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, it's all over the news recently about how, you know, huge corporations such as, you know, Apple, for instance, are hiding really, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars overseas in tax havens so they don't have to pay their fair share, as we're shifting the burden of making sure we have schools and roads and bridges and a good infrastructure and good public schools to onto the backs of, you know, average working class Americans.
But they're selling it that by lowering the corporate tax rate, that suddenly all these corporations like Apple and others like Nike, for example, will come back to the U.S. and bring jobs. And where's the...
But we've done this before, right?
Right. Where's the evidence? I don't.
Yeah, there is no evidence that they're going to come back and all the money that they have, they're going to start investing. The truth is, even with these tax havens, they have enough money. They're not hurting for money. Corporate profits are very healthy, in record territory in a lot of industries, for instance. And, you know, investment, they have the money to invest if they want to invest. Many of these corporations don't necessarily need that money. We need it for our tax base. There's no evidence that, letting them bring this money in at, you know, lower zero tax rates means it's going to parlay itself into some kind of investment, which they say then will turn into jobs, and then it will in turn into increased wages. I mean, that's their story. I have little faith that that's going to happen.
But the getting rid of the mandate in the Affordable Care Act, which is what the Senate bill is going to do now to grab those $330 billion odd, that will have consequences. I mean, first of all, it is a backdoor way to achieve what they failed to achieve so far in killing Obamacare, and there will be premium increases as a result. I mean, we already know that HHS, the guy that was booted out, was sabotaging as much as he could, procedurally cutting the budget by 90% to advertise it, cutting the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, in spite of those that effort to sabotage it on the part of the Republicans.
Yes.
Still, a lot of people have signed up. But this,
that's what I mean. People are, you know, of finding out the truth and becoming educated to the reality on the ground.
But this will have an effect, though. The Senate bill, and it will raise premiums. So that's going to clash with the attempts on the part of Senator Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray in terms of their bipartisan efforts at health care reform. So this is I'm wondering whether that will be the, you know, on the other hand, it's giving them money they want to offset the tax cuts for the rich. But on the other hand, is it likely to sway some of the wavering senators? That may be where those votes are. And we don't even know what's going to happen with the extra vote there in down there in Alabama, right?
Exactly. There's been some...
Right, and one of the Republicans is ill, the guy from Mississippi, et cetera. So they're on a pretty tight margin. And then, so what do you think is going to happen, though, with all those people that are mobilizing against what they've heard about so far? And again, this has all been done in secret. They've excluded the Democrats, and they're rushing this thing through. But already home builders, realtors, mortgage bankers, and now, of course, because of the going after the Affordable Care Act, you'll have insurers, doctors, hospitals, and the AARP. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are going to be showing up in Washington, don't you think?
Yeah, and definitely, folks that are, grouping together against this, that, you know, a lot of times you wouldn't expect them to be on the same side. We'll have to just wait and see. It's always hard to tell, but I think, you know, it definitely could go down, but who knows at this point.
Well, but what's likely to make it pass and become law? You know, there's no question that Donald Trump is desperate to sign any bill. He's had absolutely achieved nothing so far, and the Republicans are feeling the heat of how many times they fell short on repealing the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot of motivation on their part to pass it, even if they have to hold their nose and vote for it.
Well, there is, because they're getting, a lot of pressure from their very wealthy donor class, And, you know, that's kind of what's happening here. You know, this idea that we have a very wealthy elite here that put a massive amount of money into elections and elected officials because they want to get the outcomes that they're expecting from them. And so that's kind of what's happening here, because if they get the outcomes that they want, that will beget them even more wealth. That's kind of the vicious circle we've been in for quite some time. I think you're seeing it just played out now in real time.
Well, just the other day, a Republican congressman said that a donor called him up and said, if you don't pass this tax bill, never call me again. So
exactly, because, you know, that's what's happening. But that leads to, you know, the conversations that you had before about too much money in politics and too much money in our election cycles. And, you know, and really, what does it mean for our democracy in the long run?
Well, just in closing, Sylvia Allegretto, one of the most spiteful parts of the it's in the House bill, and that is how they're going to punish blue states by getting rid of the deduction for state and local taxes. And so the successful states like California that generate revenues, jobs, and a high standard of living, and to some extent already subsidize the states like Alabama and Mississippi, who get an awful lot of tax money back from more than they send to Washington, and as compared to the Californians, who get much less back from what they send to Washington, they will prosper and the blue states will be hurt. And it just seems to me like spitefulness on the part of the Republicans. How does it strike you?
Well, it does, and I think they're really hoping that, again, that their constituents in their states don't figure this out. But I love that there is another kind of, you know, parallel education going on here, the education of tax collection, especially at the federal level, and tax distribution. It really matters. And like you pointed out, the elite coasts that usually don't play very well in a lot of the, for instance, the red states, pay for a lot of the public outlays that the citizens of the red states actually get. And, you know, I think if we had a better understanding, you know, if our citizenry had a better understanding of these dynamics, that they, you know, that they would appreciate actually what's going on here more. And this kind of divisiveness between, you know, red states and blue states and the coastal elites and those in the middle of the country might not be as stark. Because that's the fact, as you just said it. The fact is that states where I'm in, California, we pay way more in to the federal government than we get back.
And we're going to lose the state and local tax deductions.
Right. That's so, really going to hurt us disproportionately.
Exactly.
In states like California and New York. That's kind of a double whammy.
Sure. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sylvia Allegretto. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.